I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. In 2018, Bayer acquired Monsanto, buying not only the agrochemical giant, but also the thousands of lawsuits filed against it for one product, Roundup. Today, the story behind the weed killer. We'll talk with a veteran journalist who dug into Monsanto's tactics to maintain Roundup's reputation, discredit scientists, and influence regulators, then wrote a book about it all. Then, Democrats found the reason many had been waiting for when a whistleblower complaint opened the door for an impeachment inquiry against President Trump. Learn the steps involved to remove a sitting president as we get you up to date after this hour's news. A lot of people now know that Roundup, the prominent weed killer, may be a health hazard, but few know that the actual steps that its manufacturer, Monsanto, has taken over the years to ensure that hundreds of millions of pounds of Roundup continue to be used on our farms and in our front yards. Journalist Carrie Gillum has documented this campaign to keep Roundup in heavy use despite its health risks that many experts say now includes cancer. She wrote about it in her book, Whitewash, The Story of a Weed Killer, Cancer, and the Corruption of Science. It's a story for our times that includes a look at how regulators wound up compromising between the insistent demands of a major corporation and the possible risks that the corporation's product posed for the nation and the world. Carrie Gillum lives in Overland Park and spent 17 years writing for Reuters. She's now a columnist for The Guardian. She's also research director for U.S. Right to Know. That's a consumer group with a mission of pursuing truth and transparency in America's food system. Carrie Gillum, welcome back to Up to Date. So nice to have you here.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, if Roundup is so dangerous, then how come so many of us are still using it?
And that's probably a question for a psychology professor, isn't
it? There you go.
I think every day we use products that we know can be dangerous to our health. I mean, certainly a number of people still smoke cigarettes, even though those risks are pretty well defined. It's a risk and reward calculation, I think, that's different for every individual. But you are seeing people around the world move away from these glyphosate-based products, Roundup and other herbicides that were developed by Monsanto. You're seeing bans discussed and promoted in Germany and Italy and France, different countries around the world. School districts and park departments and cities are moving away from using it. In the United States.
And is usage actually down? Do you have any sense of what the overall stats are for how many gallons of Roundup are being used each year?
It would be great if we could get that information from the manufacturers. It's a little tricky. We do have data that the government has put together, but that's only tracking back to about 2016, 2017. Mm-hmm. But what you can see is these different groups and cities and states and countries that are moving to ban it.
But the signals from the federal government strike me as kind of mixed here, Carrie, because as you point out in the book, Whitewash, the USDA and the FDA have been declining to test for the residue of this key ingredient you just mentioned in Roundup, glyphosate. For 20 years, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, which regulates pesticides, has been approving industry requests for higher allowable levels of glyphosate residues in food. You know, that suggests that the dangers of Roundup maybe have been overblown.
The EPA certainly takes that position, yes, that it is not likely to be carcinogenic. That's their official position.
Is it their position under the Obama administration as well as the Trump administration?
It's been their position since, 1991.
So pretty consistent.
Consistent position. You have to understand the EPA does not do any of its own original testing of these products, though. They rely very heavily on the tests that the companies that sell the products submit to them. And what we've seen and what I document in my book and what I detail through EPA's own documents is that their own scientists found reason to believe that this caused cancer back in the 1980s, the very early studies.
And what, ignored it?
And Monsanto came in and said, no, let us tell you how to look at that study. You're not analyzing these correctly. And the EPA scientists fought back in the 1980s and said, our job is not to protect you. It's to protect the public. But ultimately, Monsanto was able to convince the higher-ups, the management, and the appointed officials to overrule their own EPA scientists and to allow this to become used, you know, pervasively. It's the most widely used herbicide in all of history now.
Well, given that, why doesn't some independent group take a run at analyzing just how dangerous this stuff is?
Right. Well, and so many different independent groups have done that. And what they have found over the years is that this particular chemical in these particular formulations by Monsanto are toxic, are genotoxic, are tied to cancers, reproductive problems, a range of human health ills, as well as environmental problems. And they have published this. They have, tried to raise the alarm, so to speak. An international group of cancer scientists, the most elite group brought together by the World Health Organization, looked at all of the scientific literature and said the weight of science shows that this is a probable human carcinogen with a positive association, particularly to non-Hodgkin lymphoma.
You're choosing your words carefully here because we don't know for a fact, if I'm hearing you correctly, that Roundup causes cancer, end of story. Am I hearing that correctly, Carrie?
It's really, really difficult, as I have learned over these 20 years of covering this issue.
To make a direct causal link, yeah.
You have animal studies in which you control, the animals are in a cage, you control what they get. You see that the mice and the rats that you're giving this chemical to get tumors, and the ones who don't get it don't get tumors. Those studies are done. But we humans, we're out in the world and we're exposed to so many different things, and it's really difficult to ever tie one particular chemical, one particular substance to one particular disease in one particular person. But as we've seen in the three trials so far in this Roundup litigation, the juries have found unanimously that they have found that there is enough evidence to believe that.
And the owners of Roundup now, I guess it's Bayer, used to be Monsanto, they still say what?
So Bayer bought Monsanto, closed on the deal in June of 2018, mm-hmm. and they have adopted Monsanto's position that this doesn't cause cancer. It's not a risk. All of these scientists over all of these studies over all of these years who have said it does are wrong. And Monsanto is correct. And that's the end of the story as far as they're concerned.
What do we know about the impact on a population that has more regular contact with this product than many of us do, and that's the farming population, Carrie? What do we see happening there?
Well, I mean, over time, you have seen non-Hodgkin lymphoma pretty prevalent in the farm community. That's one disease that it's leveled off in the last few years, but it rose pretty significantly around the world in the years since glyphosate and Monsanto introduced Roundup. But it has leveled off. Now, farmers do use this. I mean, this is one of the biggest markets for these Roundup products. But farmers are aware generally that pesticides are dangerous. Many of them use pesticides on a regular basis. So they know to wear protective gear. They know that you don't handle it with your hands. You don't get it all over your skin. You wear protective boots. You wear protective gloves. And many of them also are distanced from the application. They're, in the cab of a vehicle or something. It's quite different than the person walking around their backyard in shorts and sandals with a backpack sprayer or something and, getting it all over their skin and saying, oh, it's not that big of a deal because it's so very safe.
Carrie Gillum is my guest. She's the author of Whitewash, The Story of a Weed Killer, Cancer, and the Corruption of Science. And I should point out that she'll be the keynote speaker for the 41st Annual American Association of University Women, Kansas City, and the KC Library Thorpe Men Award Luncheon. She won it last year, by the way. It'll take place at 11:30 Saturday morning at the Central Library, 14 West 10th Street. For more information, go to mo.com. www.aauw.net, and we'll put a link to that on our webpage later on today. You wrote in Whitewash that you hold, and I'm quoting here, a very real fear for my children, for your children, over what the future holds. And you're talking about the impact of products like Roundup. What do you fear most?
Well, it's not an overstatement to say that we are actually poisoning our planet. When you look at the literature, as I have, you spend 20 years with scientists and farmers and regulators and in Washington, and spending most of my time trolling through, you know, government documents and scientific studies. It's not just glyphosate. It's not just Monsanto. There are over 450 pesticides that are used in food production that leave residues in the food that we consume.
Mm-hmm.
Government regulators and researchers have documented pesticides in our water supplies, you know, in our tap water, in rainfall, in soil samples. Mm. You know, it's in our food. They're in our bodies. And these pesticides are tied not only to cancers and disease, but neurodevelopmental problems in our children. And I'm not the only one, I'm the reporter here. I didn't invent this.
Right.
Our national toxicology program, our leadership there is saying there are real dangers here. We're not protecting our children. We are leaving a legacy of disease, and we need to do something about it. If we care about our children, we care about their future.
I should have asked you sooner, Carrie, how much money does Roundup make for Monsanto, Once Upon a Time, and now Bayer? Any idea?
Oh, my goodness. Well, billions of dollars a year. It's fluctuated over time. Monsanto generally
Of dollars a year, you're saying?
Yes. Monsanto generally brought in between $3 billion and $5 billion a year in sales off of its glyphosate products.
You have stats in the book about the numbers of gallons being used of this product on the planet Earth in any one year. Just ballpark number. What are we talking about here?
Well, I mean, the fascinating thing to look at. So in the 1990s, globally, was about 124, 125 million pounds a year used globally. And that now is about 2 billion pounds. And in the United States, it was around 24 million pounds a year in the 90s. Now we're up to close to 300 million pounds a year of this just in the United States.
300 million pounds.
Lot of Roundup. It's the most widely used herbicide in all of history, and it's because Monsanto was so diligent about pushing it and promoting it, and because they refused to put warning labels on it. They refused to accept the cancer science that shows that it can be a danger. They refused to alert the consumers to the risks that are associated with this product, and because of that, it's been allowed to be used so extensively that it's found in our food, that it's found in our water, that it's found in our urine and our blood serums.
You know, one reason that use of Roundup has risen, and you point this out again in Whitewash, is because Monsanto introduced glyphosate-tolerant crops like soybeans and corn just as its patent on the chemical was about to expire. This is back in 2000. Explain these crops to us and how it changed the trajectory of Monsanto.
Yeah, I mean, it was a brilliant move.
Yeah.
Quite amazing. They, have very smart scientists, among the smartest in the world, and they've been tinkering around with crop DNA and really trying to move into that agricultural space. And they learned that they could make crops, tolerate this weed killer, which normally would kill, all vegetation. And so they rolled out genetically engineered glyphosate tolerant soybeans and corn. They now have cotton and canola and sugar beets and alfalfa. But they specifically talked about in the 90s, you can see in their internal papers and reports to investors, that this would help them hold on to that market for glyphosate, because farmers would then be beholden. They'd be using these Roundup-ready crops, Roundup-ready seeds, and they would then want to use and need to use Roundup, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And sales and market share spiked after they rolled out these special seeds. And even today, some 20 years later, these glyphosate-tolerant crops remain the most widely planted and cultivated of all types of genetically engineered crops.
Do I have it right that once upon a time, even Kerry Gillum used to use Roundup yourself? Is that right?
Oh my gosh, yeah. It did a great job, right? I mean, you have weeds and you want to get rid of them. And I bought it by the bucketfuls. I was like any other consumer. I didn't have any reason to fear it. I believe the ads.
Yeah. And just, it's off point a little bit, but if people listening to this are thinking, okay, it's time for me to stop using this product, what should they be using?
You
want to kill the dandelions.
I know. I wrestle with that all the time, right? I mean, one thing mentally I've gotten to just tell myself is, you know, dandelions aren't so bad, right? I mean, really, they're
really
not.
We make a big deal about it,
yeah,
don't we?
I spend a lot of time pulling weeds now, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are all sorts of organic solutions out there, sort of vinegar-based. You know, some people will tell you hot soapy water will do it. The larger picture for me is, you know, the weeds are not as bad as what could happen.
We have an email here from a listener named Sally, and she writes this. I'm curious to know whether the makers of Roundup have thought to take the strategy of go the route that cigarette companies did and just admit that there is a danger in using it and therefore put it on the individual's responsibility if they wind up getting sick from the product.
Right. And I mean, that's the big question here. And I think ultimately that's probably what's going to happen, that they will be forced to put a label on it. California actually instructed them to put a warning label on their products in California. They have a law that requires that when the bulk of evidence is such that it can cause cancer. And they went to court and they refused. And they thus far have refused to do that. So they're fighting tooth and nail. You know, they're trying to hold on to this market as long as they can.
How did you get started on this journey of investigating Roundup? How did that happen?
Not by choice.
Your life was going along just fine, and here you go off on this.
It's like any other reporter. You know, you're doing your job. You're covering a company. I'm assigned to cover the company and the market and the industry. And, you know, it's a very powerful industry, this agrochemical Dow and DuPont, Monsanto, Syngenta. Very, very powerful companies that control, are really revolutionizing and controlling agriculture and food production. And Reuters is an international news agency, and I had to learn everything and be out there but, you know, as I learned and as I tracked the science and as I started to see what was happening on the ground, talk to farmers, talk to environmental scientists, seed scientists, soil scientists, you know, and it became apparent that Monsanto's version of events was not actually what was happening, was not the truth, was not playing out that way.
And is that why Monsanto would not be regarded as a big fan of Cargill?
They are no longer a big fan of mine.
They were at one point.
Well, I don't know if they ever were a fan, but I mean, I was welcomed into their headquarters.
Right.
I spent a lot of time with various executives there. I've been there, you know, many, many, many times. But no, as it's been revealed, The Guardian revealed in August, they set out to destroy my reputation and my credibility. They set out to destroy my book. They had a whole action plan. They brought in consultants. They how to manipulate search engine optimization and get negative book reviews posted. And
yeah, I want to be real clear about this because you write in here that you became a target of Monsanto's ire and just this year received pages of internal Monsanto communications of its plans to target you and your reputation, as you're saying here. What else do they want to do?
Well, and again, it's only I'm one person, and we know that they've done this to other scientists. We have internal documents where they try to discredit different scientists at different universities. They try to discredit other journalists, journalists at the New York Times, journalists at, you know, other magazines. So I'm one person. I'm one example. But they did, you know, go all out to try to ruin me. They tried to keep The Guardian from publishing my articles, from working with me. Time magazine, they went after them when they published an article that I wrote. They want me out of the business.
That's really something. Scary to hear about that as a fellow journalist.
It's scary. It's also, I think, a badge of honor, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't know. I don't know. You know, they haven't been able to find anything that's wrong in my book or in my work. They're not complaining about accuracy. They just want me to go away.
Just don't like it. Cargill, her book, Whitewash, The Story of a Weed Killer, Cancer, and the Corruption of Science. Again, she speaks at 11:30 Saturday morning at the Central Library downtown. More information will be on our website later on today. What a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.
Thanks for your time.
Appreciate it.
Yeah. After we come back from a break, we'll answer your questions about how the country can impeach a president. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. You can do more than just listen to UpToDate. Sign up for Kraske Off Mic. It's some informative reading to start your week every Monday. Subscribe at kcur.org/Kraske. Tomorrow on the show, Kansas City manager Troy Schulte. He's announced he'll be stepping down in February, but there's still work to be done. He'll join me to discuss the coming months he has left and the decade he spent in office as Kansas City's city manager. That's tomorrow on KCUR. Is up to date. Well, a president can be removed from office, but only for very specific things. The Constitution says removal can happen if Congress determines that a president committed treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. The issue of impeachment now is very much back in the news over the president's efforts to pressure leaders from Ukraine to investigate former Vice President Joe Biden. But how would the process of removing President Trump from office actually work? What steps would have to be taken, and how long would it take? Well, let's find out. With us, Benjamin Woodson is an assistant professor of political science at UMKC. Ben, it's nice to have you. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I think some people will be surprised to learn that only two presidents have been impeached. I'm referring to Andrew Johnson and Bill Clinton, but no president has ever been removed from office. Do I have that right?
Oh, yes, that is correct.
Yeah, and what about Richard Nixon?
Well, he was almost impeached. He just resigned before he actually got impeached. So he was going to be impeached, then going to be removed from office. But
it didn't officially happen.
Yeah, like most likely some Republican senator showed up and said, "You're going to be impeached, so just leave before this happens." And so that sort of is what occurred.
You know, I mentioned in the opening here, Ben, that removal can happen if Congress determines that a president committed treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. I think most people know what treason and bribery are, but what about high crimes and misdemeanors? What is that exactly?
There's no clear definition of that. And in reality, it doesn't really matter because basically the president can be impeached for anything that the House deems impeachable.
So it doesn't have to be a high crime or misdemeanor.
No, not at all. So like the first impeachment inquiry was from Tyler back in the 1800s, who they tried to impeach him because he vetoed too much stuff. And so like that's clearly not a crime. That's not a misdemeanor. That's just what the president's allowed to do. But they didn't like it. And so they tried. It didn't go anywhere, but they tried to impeach him over it.
So a high crime and misdemeanor, you're saying, is strictly in the eyes of the beholder.
Whatever a majority of the House of Representatives deems an impeachable offense is considered a high crime and misdemeanor under the Constitution.
And there is absolutely no definition of high crimes, you're saying, in the U.S. Constitution.
No, none at all.
So we're flying blind here a little bit.
Pretty much.
Thanks a lot to Thomas Jefferson and everybody else right here.
You know, there's a lot about the Constitution's very vague, and how sort of our political process works is sort of made up on the fly sometimes, and this is just one of the examples of that.
Well, if our listeners have questions about this process of impeachment, part of this segment is for you to call in with your questions to help you navigate this, maybe help us all figure it out too. 816-235-2888 is our number here. Again, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. I can't help but wonder, and you may not have an answer to this, but because you weren't there then, but why aren't things more clearly spelled out in the Constitution? I mean, why didn't the founders provide a better roadmap for moments like this?
In many ways, you can't really make a Constitution that is specific on everything, because if you make it very, very, very specific for basically if they wrote something very specific for the time of like the 1790s, that's not going to work today. And so we have a vague Constitution that is kind of flexible and the meaning can change over time. And it sort of is updated through just changes in interpretation to meet the current demands.
So you're saying that the founders couldn't have been able to forecast all these different things that would come down the pike at some point down the road.
Yeah, you just sort of set up a basic process and then the current politicians of the time fill in the details. So that's sort of what it is with impeachment as well. Like there's the basic process is laid out, and they'll fill in the details as they go along.
I think you're sort of answering this here, Ben, but ultimately, scholars consider this process of removing a president from office as a highly political act. Explain that to us, because why is it highly political as opposed to something of a more legalistic proceeding when something so serious is being considered?
Well, the easiest answer is just it's done by politicians, so it's always going to be political. And also another, it also goes back to that definitions of high crimes and misdemeanors in that it's impeachment isn't about doing something illegal. Impeachment is, in many ways, is about abusing the public trust, and the definition of the public trust is a very political political process, and what is abusing the public trust for some people isn't for other people, and so it's always going to come back to that sort of political decision of whether Trump abused the public trust or didn't, and you can disagree on that.
Clearly that's the case today because we have Republicans saying he didn't do anything worthy of impeachment, Democrats saying he sure did.
It's not in many ways, it's not even really about guilty or not guilty. It's is it impeachable or not impeachable?
Yeah.
And you can commit a crime and not be impeached over it, or you cannot commit a crime and still be impeached over it.
Well, what kind of vote do you need in the House, Ben, to approve articles of impeachment? Is it 2/3, simple majority plus one? What are we looking at here?
In the House, all you need is a majority.
Okay. So it's not a heavy. How about in the Senate, if a trial is held and the Senate votes, how much of a vote would you need to actually remove the president from office?
In the Senate, you need 2/3 vote.
So it's a pretty high bar.
Yeah, it's a really, really high bar. So you need for the current situation, you need 20 Republicans. And, you know, there's a, five or so like anti-Trump Republicans that seem likely-ish to maybe vote for it. But beyond
that's a long way from 20.
Yeah, it's a long way. It's going to be very, very hard to get that number of Republicans to vote against their own president.
We're talking about how to impeach a president. We're attempting to answer your questions about this process. Our number, 816-235-2888. Let's go to some calls here, and they're coming in quickly. Bill from Overland Park. Bill, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, Steve. Thank you. Great show. Listen to you every day.
Thanks, Bill.
The question I have is, isn't this kind of all a process of frustration? And by that, I mean, the House may impeach Trump, but the Senate has to vote to remove him from office. The odds of that happening are slim. So what did we really accomplish by going through the process of impeachment if the Senate's not going to remove the guy?
What about that, Ben?
Well, the Democrats' response to that would be that they need to sort of show Trump that there's going to be consequences for his actions. So they believe that he's abusing the public trust, using his position for his own personal gain. And even if the Senate isn't going to impeach him, we need to basically make the Republicans in the Senate say, this is fine. And sort of make Trump know that he will be held at least to some account. Even if he doesn't actually end up getting removed, there will be some sort of investigation of his actions.
What do you think, Bill? Maybe Bill left us here.
I think the whole thing's a mess, and unfortunately, we're not conducting the business of the people. I think it's also political motivated, but let's see how it plays out.
Sounds good, Bill. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Let's go to Jeff from the east side of Kansas City. Jeff, you're on Up to Date.
Thank you very much. My question has to do with the trial in the Senate. What role exactly does the Senate play? But also, what role does the Supreme Court play in this? I believe the Chief Justice presides over the proceedings, or how that all plays out. You know, is the role of the Senate to be a jury, or prosecutors, or what? You know, and what role does the Supreme Court play?
Yeah, Jeff, thank you for the good questions. And I think for a lot of us, it's been a number of years since Bill Clinton went through this in the Senate. We've lost track a little bit of how all this plays out. What is the Senate's job here? How will this play out?
Well, the Senate's job is to hold the trial. And so the Senate acts as the jury. So how it will work is the House will appoint some members of the House to act essentially as prosecutors. And so they'll present the case against Trump. Then Trump will have some type of defense lawyer present his case. And then the Senate is supposed to hear evidence. They can call witnesses. They can investigate. They can get documents and stuff like that if they really want to. Or if they don't want to, they cannot do that. It's kind of up to the Senate basically to run the trial however they want. Well, it's up to the Republicans in control of the Senate to determine how the trial is going to be run. And so then they'll just act as the jury and vote whether he is guilty or not guilty. And there is a role for the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court.
He presides over the trial, doesn't he?
Yeah, he presides over the trial, but he doesn't really have any real power. Like, it's just, he doesn't really have any power. It's going to be up to whatever the Republicans in the Senate want to do.
When Bill Clinton went through this, did the Chief Justice at that time sit in on Bill Clinton's trial?
So if you ever watch, like, C-SPAN and you see the guy with the gavel, like, banging the gavel up the front, it's just the Chief Justice, the guy sitting up there instead. And again, but he doesn't really seem to have too much authority or too much power to really do much.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it really is the Senate gets to create the rules for themselves, and if they can run the trial pretty much however they want to.
And visiting with Ben Woodson, who's an assistant professor of political science at UMKC, about the process of impeaching a president. Just on this point of the Senate's involvement, Ben, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, a Republican, obviously, has said he'd be required to take up the matter in the Senate if the House sends it over. But he's also implied that he may not spend much time on it. Is he required to hold a trial?
As the Senate rules are currently written, he's like required to start a trial. And so, but like 10 minutes after that, they can introduce a resolution to end the trial. And so if they get a majority vote in the Senate to end the trial, like 5 minutes after it starts, they can do that. It's just, they need to get a majority of the senators to vote for it.
So in theory, then, you're saying it's possible this whole thing could be really anticlimactic in the Senate if they bring it up and then call it off within just a matter of minutes.
If there's no Republicans in the Senate that will support at least an impeachment inquiry or like at least a trial, then as soon as it gets brought to the Senate, as soon as the House files articles of impeachment, the Senate could just do a quick vote and end the whole thing.
You know, not to nitpick here, but what if there are four Republican senators who are saying, yes, we should go forward here? Would that compel McConnell to go ahead and have a trial?
He would have to have some semblance of a trial. But again, what that looks like, that could be just as simple as like 2 days of like opening statements and then you go to a vote, or it could be as much as you set up a new committee, you subpoena witnesses, you try to get a bunch of documents and stuff like that, and they do their own investigation. Like, it could be anywhere between like 1 day to months.
I guess what I'm trying to understand here is what's the distinction here between Senate Majority Leader McConnell, you know, calling for a trial and then canceling it in 5 minutes, or actually going ahead and doing a semblance of a trial? Is there a certain number of Republican senators who you need to push the process forward into some kind of trial and force a trial to be held?
You just need four, as you said.
You
need to make sure that there's not a majority support for ending the trial. And so
majority support. I got you. Yeah, that makes sense. Majority rules in the Senate. Okay. Let's go back to some calls. And Dylan from Kansas City, Missouri. Dylan, you're on the air.
Hi, guys. I'm wondering if there is a mechanism in the Constitution, if, say, the president is impeached and removed, to nullify or reverse any legislative accomplishments, for example, the tax bill. Or is it on to business as usual with Vice President Pence stepping in?
Would his accomplishments be nullified, if I'm understanding Dylan correctly here, Ben?
No, not at all. Like, all the laws that he passed, all the laws he signed, all the executive orders, everything he's done still sort of counts as if he wasn't impeached.
You know, one thing that people wonder here is, how long is all this going to last? We're obviously engaged in the process now on the House side. Are we going to be dealing with this in December, or what's your sense?
The House seems to want to do this very, very quickly. So they seem to want to get the articles of impeachment done in October. So they want to move as quickly as possible. Like, you can't – it's not going to happen like next week. But then once that happens, then it's moves to the Senate. And my sense – like, again, it could be months from now. That could take months, or that could take days. But my sense is they will hold some type of short trial and – but try to do it quickly. So they don't want to leave this until like right up before the election. And so you want to get this done as quickly as possible. There's an incentive on both sides to get this done quickly and to get this sort of over with, because the Republicans want it out of the news and the Democrats, well, they just want to remove Trump. So,
you know, as you're watching all this unfold, is there any doubt in your mind, Ben, that Democrats in the House will wind up approving these articles of impeachment and push the thing over to the Senate? Does that seem almost like a foregone conclusion to you?
Yes, that's pretty much a foregone conclusion.
And why do you say that?
Because partisanship rules American politics, and all the Democrats are going to vote against Trump on this. And it's not like there's any doubt of what Trump did, really. At least the stuff about asking Ukraine to investigate Biden, like, that's impeachable for most, virtually all Democrats, and he's admitted to doing that. And so they're going to vote on just that alone would be enough for the Democrats in the House to impeach him.
Right. You know, some lawmakers, like Kansas Senator Pat Roberts, who's a Republican, says he wants to continue working on issues. But my sense is, if the impeachment process gets rolling, that's going to be awfully tough to do. As you watch this, Ben, what do you think?
Well, they won't work on issues if the impeachment process is ongoing. But also, if the impeachment process wasn't ongoing, they also wouldn't do anything. So it's not like anything substantial is going to get done between now and the election, even without impeachment. Like, in our polarized politics with sort of the checks and balances and all that sort of stuff, like, nothing was going to get done. The Democrats and Trump aren't going to agree on something big. And so the impeachment isn't really stopping anything, because nothing would get done anyway.
Oh, what's wrong with this process? If you could wave your magic wand, what would you change about it?
I've never actually sort of thought about that, I guess, but I can't think of anything, because everyone likes to complain that, like, the process is too political. Like, why can't everyone sort of get along and just sort of agree on basic set of facts moving forward? But also, that's just sort of politics. That's how politics operates. Politics is about conflict over things, and there's always going to be conflict no matter what, and you can't take that conflict out of the process. And so there's not there doesn't seem to be a better way to do it, because it is just a matter of the House and the Congress needs to decide whether the president needs to be removed. And anytime you're going to do that, it's going to be politicized. There's going to be conflict, and people are going to get very, very angry on both sides. And that's just sort of inevitable.
I presume all this is going to be televised, right?
Almost everything. So it does involve intelligence. So the main stuff is in the House Intelligence Committee, and then it'll be in the Senate Intelligence Committee. And a lot of that stuff is going to be classified.
Oh.
So as long as it's not classified, then it will most likely be televised. And some of them won't be. So right now, Kurt Volker, I believe, I'm pretty sure I got the first name right, is doing a deposition, but that's behind closed doors. And maybe that transcript might come out later today, but, like, it's sometimes just easier to do it behind closed doors, because then the politics kind of gets out of it, and the politicians don't have to put on a show like they would if it's a public one. And so some of the stuff like that might be behind closed doors, but eventually that will all become public, most likely.
That's Ben Woodson. He's an assistant professor of political science at UMKC. Thanks for the good education on impeachment. Sure appreciate it, Ben.
Well, thanks for having me.
Coming up, Brian and Spencer talking about some fun stuff to do this weekend. Boy, that's a good song. KCUR contributor Brian McTavish is here. He follows and writes about pop culture. With him, Spencer Hardwick, founder and curator of Wire KC Weekender. They joins us here in the studio each week with ideas for your weekend. Gentlemen, how are you? Welcome back.
Hey.
It is sweater weather. I have no complaints.
Oh, it was time for you, eh?
It's definitely time.
I get that.
All the sweaters from the basement.
I had to put a coat on this morning.
Yeah, here you are wearing your Frankenstein t-shirt just in time for
That's
Halloween
right.
here.
That's
we're,
right.
We're playing Beatles because Woo! We're going to be hearing Beatles in town tonight,
tonight
right?
Tonight, 7:30 yeah. tonight. I think there might be even several dozen tickets left at the box office.
Yeah, you think?
I think so. I checked. It's a tribute to the Beatles' White Album. Todd Rundgren, Mickey Dolenz of the Monkees, Christopher Cross, Jason Scheff. He was with Chicago for at least 10 or 15 minutes. Joey Molland, who was in Badfinger.
What a band.
They're going to take
what
the John, Paul, George, and Ringo Wayback Machine to 1968. Once again, 7:30 tonight. You should be there. I'll be there at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. I know I'll be there. So this... where to begin? Well, it's been called the Beatles' most eclectic album.
Yeah.
And it is, if only because each member of the band at that time was just basically bringing in their own stuff.
Because they were starting to split up.
That's the story. Yes. And they were bringing in their own diverse songs. The other guys were sort of just playing on them. There was a lot less collaboration, right? It was almost like they were saying, yeah, okay, Beatlemanians, Sgt. Pepper's, and all that zany psychedelic stuff, be gone. We're going to start over with a clean slate. The album was actually called The Beatles, but it was white on the front and white on the back, and so it became known as the White
Album.
Well,
are these guys who are coming here, these music superstars, I guess, are they going to reinterpret this thing or just play it? What are they doing?
Well, they better not reinterpret it. No, I think they're going to do most of the album, and then they'll do some of their own hits. Like,
okay.
You know, Mickey Dolenz, he's going to, you know, still be a believer and, you know, Pleasant Valley Sunday.
Can you imagine that?
You should go if you're
7:30
not sure.
tonight at the Kauffman Center, right?
Be there or don't be a Beatles fan.
Cheddar, cheddar, a national treasure. You smoke your cheese flavor, delivers pure pleasure. Grated, you great. Toasted, you tasty. If I said you're the best, please don't think me too hasty. Yellow big cheese, but you're pleased, you're destined.
Is that really the cheddar cheese song? Is that what we're looking at there?
Do you know how hard it is to find a song about cheese?
But we found one.
It was very worth it. And so, there are
not
few...
a great classic of all time, I don't think.
No,
but,
it will not get that. But this is actually was a pretty brilliant idea. This is the KC Grilled Cheese Festival, the second annual. Steve, this is a one-day event where they're showing off your favorite childhood food, or everyone's favorite childhood
grilled
food.
Grilled cheese festival. Who and came up with this idea to do a grilled cheese festival?
That's a great idea. I don't have that on me at the moment. What I do know is that it's super family friendly.
Well, I can only imagine.
Bounce houses, face painting, there's even a bar, so they're literally covering the spectrum.
How good is the grilled cheese?
That's the $1 million question, but I'm assuming if you're going to throw a grilled cheese festival, the product better be pretty good. What are you guys' favorite cheese, really quickly?
Anything with a tomato on it, including grilled cheese.
And the thought that occurs, I agree with that.
Exactly. Everything's better with a tomato. But the thought that occurs to me is if any moms are there, aren't they just going to push the chefs out of the way and make their own grilled cheese sandwiches?
My mother did teach me that the secret is butter, and I'm a provolone guy myself.
Oh, I get that. Butter. This is noon to four Saturday down at Isles Park downtown, right?
Absolutely.
Right in front of the Federal Courthouse.
Street.
Yeah.
Yep.
Sounds like country to me.
Yeah.
Am I right? Am I just guessing there? Is that a country music artist?
Well, you might be guessing, but sometimes you're right anyway because it's country out the you-know-what. It's Luke Combs.
Yes.
It's 7 o'clock Friday at Sprint Center. No frills. Delivers the country goods. Burly guy. Big beard. Ball cap.
They're all burly with a big beard. Ball cap, aren't they?
Well, he's the one they like now.
Because Old Town Road, that guy's not big and burly.
Yeah. So anyway, Luke Combs, Friday night, Sprint Center. He's the winner of the Country Music Association's Best New Artist Award for 2018, and he's on his Beer Never Broke My Heart tour, right? He's breaking all the records. His last six singles have all reached number one on the country charts, and as far as Beer Never Breaking Your Heart, I'd have to go along with that. A little bit of off-the-cuff wisdom. It's your heart that he or she breaks first, and then it's time for the beer. Beer doesn't break your heart.
That is really profound, Brian.
It is
I appreciate
indeed.
You straightening us all out.
Well, it only took $5 to get you to say that. It's important to be woefully dumped as responsibly as possible. So I'd say keep it to a six-pack. Just keep it to a six-pack.
7 p.m. Friday at the Sprint Center.
Luke Combs.
How do they do that? Let's talk disco.
Yes,
disco.
That song can only mean one thing, and that's disco. But I got a different type of disco for you. This is a silent disco. This is something I became familiar with when I was in New York as a DJ. So there are two big things that happen with parties. You know, the DJ drops a song, and not everyone's super pleased with whatever the record is.
Right.
And then there's the noise issue that really kept cropping up in New York. The silent disco solves both of those problems. Partygoers come into the venue, and they're given a set of wireless headphones. There are three or four DJs playing, and so then the partygoers can switch between the different channels of songs that the DJs are playing.
Wow.
And so if you walk around without headphones on, it looks like a big silent party with people just belting out song lyrics. Some are doing the cha-cha, some are doing, you know, the rodeo, and some are just, you know, kind of clapping their hands. It's
sounds
a pretty
kind of fun.
Amazing spectacle.
Where's this going to take place?
This is going to be at Union Station, 7:30 to midnight, and the theme is glow, so make sure you pack your neon.
Okay. We have here, Brian?
Antiquer Alert. Okay, I put together a super collector-friendly and arguably wistful combo of two more or less nostalgia-driven events. It makes me a bit wistful. Can we all collectively sign anticipation? But I'll do it anyway. Okay, first, it's the Junkers Jamboree, 8 to 2 on Saturday. Don't be late. Get there at 7:30. You don't want to miss the junk. It's vintage and homemade items, outdoor flea market.
I'm trying to get rid of the junk in my house.
Oh, no. You got it all wrong. No. Give it to me. I'll curate the junk and give it back to you. You'll think it's brand new. It's the Junkers Jamboree, 8 to 2 Saturday, historic downtown Bonner Springs. And check out the Kansas Record Show, 9 to 4 Sunday, Record Collector's Paradise at the Overland Park American Legion Post, 7500 West 75th in Overland Park.
All right. I always sort of like this song. It's actually become sort of part of the wallpaper sound of Kansas City.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So this is very soothing. So if you're not if you are lactose intolerant, can't do grilled cheese, not a fan of silent disco or the Beatles, you should
unwind. We got one more for you.
Exactly. You should unwind at Waterfire KC, which is being held as a public art phenomenon. Zanzibar Drums, Trio Forte performers, and artists like Quixotic, Rhythmic Flames. All of these guys are coming together for a visual art representation on the banks. Can I call it the banks of Brush Creek?
Well, let's do it. And it's moved a little bit to the east this year, over in front of the Nelson Atkins, sort of down by
these
parks.
It shifted a little bit. So
okay.
One of the more recognizable images is the floating bonfire.
Oh, absolutely. That's Brian McTavish and Spencer Hardwick with some fun stuff to do this weekend. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on the show, Kansas City Manager Troy Schulte joins us as he prepares to wrap up his 10 years of public service. He's arguably the most powerful man in Kansas City. You won't want to miss it. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Jamie Hobbs. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.